Hello and welcome to the Nature Garden Podcast with me, Carl Steinson, and the Weekending Show team from Lionheart Radio. In this episode, Tom Patson is getting ready for National Tree Week and looking at the ecological wonder of trees. Can you imagine 100,000 birds flying together in amazing synchronicity? Tom Cadwallander reports from Starling headquarters at the Somerset Levels. And we're going retro as Steve Lowe delves into the world of period fashion and flintlocks. Plus some top tips for the garden from Tom Pattinson, all coming up on the Weekending Show. National Tree Week is the UK's largest annual tree celebration, marking the start of the winter tree planting season, which is from November to March every year. And it's also a chance to bring people together to celebrate and plant trees across the country. Here's Tom to tell us more.
The COP26 conference in Glasgow over the past week or so has highlighted yet again the importance of trees in our fight against advancing global warming. It also coincides with National Tree Planting Week, which kicks off the 27th of November, a fortnight today. This heralds the beginning of planting, but planting doesn't need to take place necessarily in that week. It can continue for 4 months over the winter, in the absence of frost, of course, until March. So, what is National Tree Planting Week? Well, it started off in 1973, in the wake of that great Dutch elm disease outbreak, which eventually wiped out an estimated 60 million elm trees in the UK. The call was made by two MPs who said, we must try to replace those trees that have been lost. So it came through schools, and I happened to be teaching science at the time. After training in gardening and lecturing in horticulture, I moved into teaching of science, and I took out a group of really keen students to plant a few trees. It following the next year, I think it was something like, the slogan was plant more in 74. We did that too. And the Tree Council took over the baton and have kept the system going. Gosh, it must be approaching 50 years now, and it continues to this day. The intervening years have brought lots of doom and gloom as far as trees are concerned. We've had adverse weather, that great storm of 1987 that claimed 15 million trees. And of course, there have been pests and diseases, outbreaks over time. For example, that Phytophthora ramorum fungal disease with no current cure, it hit large trees. They had to be felled. So several million are suggested have gone over the past 20 years or so. There's also ash dieback, Calara, which is estimated to claim possibly 120 million trees in the coming decades. And the oak processionary moth, another one. They breed on oak trees. The caterpillars feed on the leaves, and they often travel nose to tail as they're feeding. And this is the source of the descriptive name. Add to this the gradual destruction of forested areas worldwide by humankind, and of course the challenge of global warming. Trees have got a lot to facing them, so they need our help. First and foremost, we must replace those trees that are being lost to disease. And then secondly, we must raise the numbers massively, because I see if we're fighting against global warming and of the planet, trees are the most natural defence mechanism they have to be our vanguard in fighting a battle against this this global warming. It's carbon is being pushed out into the atmosphere, too much carbon. And of course, what do trees absorb through their leaves when they're photosynthesizing? Carbon dioxide in the process of making food. And they give out oxygen, life-giving oxygen for life on Earth, plants and animals. So we must protect the trees and increase the numbers. They're our vanguard. How do we do that? Well, keep on planting. They bring so many positives to our lives, practically, aesthetically, and spiritually. A diversity of wildlife, vertebrate and invertebrate, they rely on their presence too. You know, it's difficult to appreciate the contribution they make to the planet. For example, just try to estimate how many leaves there are in the canopy of a mature tree, a very tall tree like ash, oak, elm, sycamore. Impossible to estimate, but try it, and then multiply that by the billions of trees in existence throughout the world. Yes, billions. And you get some idea of how much carbon absorbing they are doing.
The magical murmurations of starlings are a breathtaking sight, one of the wonders of the natural world. Tom Cadwallader's been to Somerset to watch their aerial gymnastics and to see how cattle egrets and livestock live together.
Last night we got the chance to experience one of the most wonderful natural history spectacles you could imagine, and it was a starling murmuration. And we kind of know of these starling murmurations, you know, these big gatherings of birds as they come into roost. And it's a wintertime phenomenon. But anyway, we were at the RSPB Reserve Ham Wall in Somerset, on the Somerset Levels in the Avalon Marshes. What a romantic name that is. It's wonderful. Anyway, we heard about this, and it's actually quite famous anyway. So we got there on site. We had the whole day there and walked around, and we had a good look at all the kind of birds that they were gathering along the marsh areas. But it was the evening that we were after, and we were sort of on position, on point for about sort of 3:45, and the first birds started to arrive at about 4:05, and there was just small groups at first. Then groups got bigger, they amalgamated. They were coming from the left, they were coming from the right, they were coming from the east, they were coming from the west, the north, the south, they were just coming from everywhere, and they would just amalgamate into huge groups of swirling masses of birds. And the locals tell us, it's hard to estimate the numbers, of course, but the locals tell us that there was something like 100,000 birds coming into the roost that evening. And they would fly around, and it was just incredible. They were just creating all sorts of shapes and so forth. And associated with these starlings flying around, we had sparrowhawks hunting them, of course, marsh harriers, the one or two marsh harriers there, which was really nice for someone up here from Northumberland. We don't see marsh harriers very often, and occasionally a buzzard would go through spooking them all as well. But there was a swirl around then, and at about 4:30, they disappeared, shot straight into the reeds, the Phragmites reeds, where they were going to roost for the night. And then you think, well, it's all done now. Then all of a sudden, another group would appear, another sort of couple of 3,000 or whatever, and they would just swirl around as well and gather and another. And the noise they were making, we were standing maybe about 30, 40 metres from where they were going in, and it was just incredible. Ah, man, it was so uplifting. We just got big smiles on our faces. But these birds are coming from Scandinavia to spend the winter in the UK. And they kind of gather in. I know we know of murmurations in Northumberland. You know, East Chevington's quite famous, and so is Holy Island. But they're not to this sort of scale. We're talking 100,000 birds. Ah, just amazing. Absolutely fantastic. So, yes, it's if you get the chance to go to a murmuration, go and see it. It is wonderful. But the Somerset Levels are just, what a fantastic landscape. It is low-lying area, and it's peat, and it's the underlying soil is peat. It's because the vegetation has rotted there, and it's just it gets flooded. And in the winter time, it plays hosts to big numbers of wildfowl coming down from the far northern Scandinavia and Russia, for example, to spend the winter. We've got widgeon, we had teal, hooper swans, and there was cranes there. But the thing about it is, what the attraction is during the breeding season, Howe Moor has become the place for early colonising birds in the UK to start to breed, these water birds. And in the wintertime, there's still a few of them around. Great white egrets. You know, we're getting slightly accustomed to seeing little egrets around. You know, the white herons with the black legs and the yellow feet. Well, these great white egrets are, again, Mediterranean species, Eastern European species. And they're about the size of a grey heron. All white, of course, but they've got yellow bills and dark legs. And these birds breed in the Somerset Levels, and Ham Wall in particular. And they breed there in quite good numbers. And some of them will stay over and winter. So they're about the size of a grey heron, so they're quite substantial birds. But also, what we've been seeing is cattle egret. Now, cattle egret are an incredibly tropical species, and they associate with cattle because cows and so forth are wandering around in fields, they're kicking up insects and invertebrates. And the cattle egrets have got this great sort of symbiotic relationship where they will just feed around the cattle, and they will just gather up all the food they can. And these birds are just completely unheard of, and they're they're an incredible rarity where in Northumberland, you know, I've only ever seen two cattle egrets in Northumberland, whereas yesterday I saw something like 50, 55 cattle egrets just in fields around the Somerset Levels. And it's not just the egrets. We've had small herons there, the little bitterns breeding there, which is kind of an extremely rare bird. So this is kind of at the vanguard, if you like, of kind of early colonisation of a lot of these southern and eastern species. And this is as a result of climate change. And we're seeing quite an interesting sort of contrast. And eventually we will see those sort of species, I surmise, coming to the north of the country if the habitat's right for them to breed in. But yes, what a wonderful experience. You know, I've travelled quite extensively around the world, and I've seen some amazing things. But actually, these last few days in Somerset have proved to be just as fulfilling as some of these big adventures. And it's great. And it was a sure case of levelling up, if you like, of some of the wildlife experiences. Brilliant. Oh, highly recommended.
Tom's a big fan of trees and shrubs which look great in the garden and can help to save the planet. We can all play a part and plant something, but there are so many choices, aren't there? Here's Tom to help us to see the wood for the trees.
I've been giving the heads up on tree planting, and shrubs, of course, if they have leaves too and they photosynthesize, they absorb carbon too. So trees, ornamental trees, fruit trees and bushes and shrubs, they're all in the same way on our side in the fight against global warming. So giving the heads up early gives you time to think about the possibilities for planting, about distances apart, and about choices. Which ones do you choose for your garden? Is it a small garden? Is it a large garden? It makes a difference. But trees can be raised either sexual means from seed, which most of them are commercially. Don't forget, it's an infinite resource. We can keep on producing trees until the cows come home, so to speak. So it's not running out. We can keep reaping out to raise them sexually from seed, or asexually from tissue culture or grafting, or taking shoots, offshoots from them. Various ways of doing it, asexually too. Nonetheless, their future is in our hands. So if you are thinking of planting a tree, think big, think small. They can become giants with wide-spreading canopies and underground root systems. Now, those underground root systems, generally speaking, are a mirror image of the topmost canopy. So if you look at the canopy of a very large tree, then you can estimate how far the roots are going to travel underground. And this is an important thing to think about if you are planting in a garden or near structures, near your home, near your garage, near something that has been built and can be undermined. The canopy can also be a problem if it's planted too close to the house. So you need a rule of thumb in terms of distance of planting. My rule of thumb is to ascertain the height of the tree or the shrub will reach at maturity and plant almost the same distance away from any structures. For example, the oak, ash, sycamore and elm, those big trees, are capable of reaching 25 metres higher. So the same number of paces in yards from the base of the trunk of the tree or the spot you're going to plant it, that's a safe distance from any structures, including your dwelling. That's a beginning. When you're selecting a site for fruit trees in the garden, the same principle applies as far as I'm concerned. Apart from the obvious open sunny area, think about the structures and the distance they are apart. Again, examples from my own garden. Apples, pears and plums grafted onto vigorous rootstocks are capable of reaching 10 metres at maturity. We're talking 30 plus feet. So, that's the safe distance to plant away from a structure. Those on dwarfing rootstocks are a different matter. Apples, say, I have some apples on the M27, most dwarfing rootstock. After 10 years, they've levelled out at about 2 metres high. So that's the safe planting distance from a structure. Plums, I've got a Victoria plum, self-fertile of course, on the Pixie dwarfing rootstock. It's a slightly different matter. They achieve 4 metres tall after we've had this one for about 20 years now, and it's about 12 feet or plus or 4 metres tall. So it was originally planted 4 metres from the garage, so we're safe with that. Now there are other plums planted on giant rootstocks, taller rootstocks. They're capable of going up to 15 metres tall. 10 to 15 anyway, so it makes a difference what type of rootstock the fruit tree is planted onto. Happily, several species of popular ornamental trees, say cherry, I have the winter cherry, I call it the winter cherry, Prunus, Subhortella, Autumnalis, Rosea. It's just started flowering and it will flower from November now, way through to next April. Brilliant value for a small ornamental fruit tree in your garden. Mine is about 4 metres tall now, 4 to 5 metres tall, and it's that distance from the garage yet again, a different part of the garden. Trees are the longest lived of all organisms as far as I'm concerned. I saw the bristlecone pine in North America. It was around when the pharaohs ruled Egypt. And a yew tree in the UK is of almost similar age, believe it or not. And olives can live for millennia. A proud moment once, I stood next to a small group of ancient gnarled olives still producing fruit on the mount opposite Jerusalem's walls. Magical experience that was for any gardener. If only they could talk like those trees on Lord of the Rings trilogy. We must keep planting trees, and they might yet be our saviour in this current crisis.
Restoring buildings is a painstaking job, and once the main part is completed, bringing them to life to show and tell our heritage can really help to make them attractive places to visit. Steve Lowe's been chatting to one of the period characters of the Creswell Peel Tower.
Hi, this is Steve. I'm here at Creswell Peel Tower again. It's 31st of October, Halloween. We've had quite a good day. The weather's been really, really odd. Pouring down and now it's particularly sunny. But I'm here with Dave, who's one of our volunteers. And hi, Dave.
Hello there, Steve.
How you all right?
Yeah. Good, thank you.
Yeah, now you add a bit of extra colour to Cresswell Peel Tower.
You could say that.
You could say that, yeah. Can you describe what you're wearing?
Yes, certainly. So I'm wearing a late 16th century common man's outfit consisting of a doublet and hose, a woolen overcoat, and I'm also wearing a rapier and carrying a musket and powder flask.
And you've just this minute put down a rather large weapon.
Yes, indeed. It's what's known as an arquebus. It's a 16th century version of a musket. Predates the type of musket that they used to use in the Civil War. It's called a matchlock. That means that it's ignited or fired using a piece of rope which is impregnated with saltpeter, which dips into the pan with the powder and sets off the musket.
Not that we've been setting it off, obviously.
Not that we've been setting it off, no.
A bit dangerous to do that in public.
Yes, exactly. It's basically a shotgun.
Yeah.
You need a special license to hold the black powder.
Yeah.
Which I haven't actually got yet, so next year perhaps.
It's a hefty piece of kit.
It weighs about 10 pounds, I think.
Really? That's a lot, isn't it? And it was fired from the shoulder, wasn't it?
It was fired from the shoulder. It's fired in a similar way to a modern shotgun.
Yeah.
It's a shape of weapon that's basically stayed the same for about 400 years.
Fantastic. So, as I say, you've started coming along and adding that little bit of extra colour to what we're doing. And we've got other people who are also interested in doing that as well, which is great. You made your own clothing?
Yes, most of what I'm wearing I actually made myself.
Brilliant.
Obviously not the musket, but I used to be a reenactor in a previous existence.
Yeah.
So I learned some basic sort of leatherworking and sewing skills.
Fantastic.
Which I've used to quite good effect with this outfit.
It's excellent, have you? I mean, there's a lot of interest, obviously, with you lurking around the base of the tower there. People are coming up and asking you questions. You get loads and loads of inquiries, don't you?
I mean, people do show an interest. Today I've given some people a demonstration of how to light a match for a matchlock using a flint and steel, which went down quite well. And very surprisingly, it actually worked first time.
Oh, brilliant, yeah.
it must be a first for me. But yes, people are interested once you start talking to them about the technology of the period and also the history, of course.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we find on the site in general, is that loads and loads of people are interested. And having something like this means they can ask a question rather than actually just, looking at something.
That's right. And, we do try and be as approachable as possible as well.
Yeah,
I don't like to sit behind a table, with all my wares spread out. I like to be in amongst people and, sort of mingle with them and, encourage them to come up and talk to me.
It's the best way, I think. And, we're obviously, as I said before, we're trying to get more people to do this. You would feel very comfortable if you had other people around doing that. Maybe
yes,
we could have a few other periods as well, maybe at some point, who
exactly.
knows?
But I mean, the history of Cresswell, goes back a long way.
And, absolutely.
I'd like to see people from, a variety of periods wandering the grounds and,
that'd be brilliant.
Doing day-to-day tasks.
And you're a volunteer. So I'm volunteer coordinator, so it's great to have people like yourself. There's loads of opportunities for people to get involved here, and you're living proof of that, so
absolutely.
It's brilliant.
I'd encourage anybody to have a go.
Fantastic.
It's really good fun, and I think it's people enjoy seeing it.
Yeah, great. Thanks very much, Dave.
You're
welcome.
We'll
speak to you soon.
Here's Tom with some things to be getting on with in the garden.
Well, I've come into the greenhouse to do jobs for the week. It's relatively warm in here. It's an unheated greenhouse, 24 feet by 10, an Alton, timber framed. I love it. It works for itself all the year round, and especially at this time of year when I'm anticipating the first frosts, which arrived this morning, by the way. The lawn was white when I got up. I came here and Outside, I have attached to the timber of the greenhouse a maximum minimum thermometer. It read -2 Celsius. That's the start for me of frost. I came inside, I also have a maximum minimum thermometer here, and it was registering 4+ Celsius. See the difference? Just with some no particular artificial heat, just the protection that this glass gives. I use the same protection, I'm sure you do as well, to my advantage in the garden, with a plastic cloche, polytunnel, anything of that nature that helps things along. And speaking of helping things along, I'm looking along the greenhouse here, and I brought on a Christmas rose, Helleborus niger. That's the white Christmas rose. The niger, by the way, refers to the roots, which are black. The flowers certainly aren't, they're beautifully white. And I have three lovely white flowers emerging just through bringing this plant in its pot, it stood outside for a long time, into the greenhouse, and this moderate calm that we have in here, and 10 Celsius at the moment, which is quite comfortable. So that's doing well, along with quite a few pelargonium cuttings. As I look around, the chrysanthemums are flowering as well. I have some late early chrysanthemums, if you see what I mean. They grow outdoors, but they hadn't quite opened their buds yet, so I transfer them into here. When I took the tomato crop out, I planted them in the border, and now they're flowering. There's a lovely white called Gompie white, and it has actually some little yellow centres in one or two of the flowers, and some are pure white, some have little yellow centres, and some have turned pink. Quite an interesting early variety of chrysanthemum. Gompie, it's called, G-O-M-P-I-E. Had it for the first time this year. I'll certainly be saving the roots of that, the rootstock, when it's finished, and raise cuttings from it next year. I've just brought the late chrysanthemums into the greenhouse. There are reds, there are pinks, there are whites amongst those, and the buds are just starting to open up slightly early, so they will develop over the coming days. That's quite amazing, frankly, having flowers in here at the moment. Now, anything left outside, I did mention the frost. I have outside things like the globe artichoke. Can't move it, it grows in the garden. We have it for the bees, of course, and the butterflies for display, the flowers, but we also eat the sepals of those lovely, tasty buds. So we have it as a vegetable as well. But unfortunately, it does not like the frost. So we heap up some hay, has some straw over the crown, and put some soil over that, and that suffices. Leave it in situ, and that gives it protection against the frost. Other things that are outside, we have some citrus fruits in pots, and they come inside. And if the bay trees, we have some bay trees, they're in big pots now. There's just not room in here, but they've been out for a few years and they're really acclimatizing themselves to the situation out there. They can handle it. We planted a peregrine peach in here years ago. Something like that, you're planting for the first time in an unheated greenhouse, then cover it with fleece the first year, as we did. Now it's just, it doesn't need any cover at all. It's as tough as anything. And we've been down to -5 in here last year in the unheated greenhouse. And it survived that, so it'll survive anything. I'm boxing up the geraniums from outside, putting them in the greenhouse bench here to see them over winter, fuchsias. And of course, I've mentioned the chrysanthemums. Those strawberry plants, I'm lifting one or two, putting them in the pots, because I'd like to have some strawberries early in June each year. And they just tick over in here, flower early and fruit early. I've got to bring the potatoes in. I've got some potatoes ready for Christmas, or they'll be ready for Christmas. They're outside at the moment. They've actually, surprisingly, they stood up to -2 degrees Celsius last night in the frost. They're looking perky now that the sun's out. I'll bring them in now, and they'll stay in here, and we'll have fresh potatoes, Charlotte, for Christmas, which, by the way, is not too far away. Outside, winter cherry, viburnum dawn, the lovely pink fragrant dawn, and Mahonia charity. racemes of long golden yellow flowers, highly fragrant. They're all flowering at the moment. Do you know, it's not so bad this time of year. We'll survive. Whatever you're doing, enjoy your gardening.
You've been listening to Gardener Tom Pattinson, Birder Tom Cadwallander from the British Trust for Ornithology, and Steve Lowe from the Northumberland Rivers Trust and Cresswell Peel Tower. I'm Carl Steinson, and enjoy your gardening and time outdoors with nature. Bye for now.